Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Brain Trust Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Pleasure to welcome you here today to another installment in our ongoing series of conversations with prominent figures in psychopharmacology on prominent topics, at least topics that should be prominent and front of mind in the eyes of many of us who are seeing patients with a diversity of major psychiatric conditions and thinking about nuanced issues in the management and care of patients, psychopharmacologically speaking. So today it's a real pleasure and honor to have with us as our guest, our very own Dr. John J. Miller. John is, among other things, medical director of Brain Health in Exeter, New Hampshire. He's a consulting psychiatrist at Seacoast Mental Health Center in Exeter and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, consulting psychiatrist, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And not the least of importance, John is the editor-in-chief of Psychiatric Times. John is the host and a mastermind of this very series. So with great humility, John, I welcome you to our program today.
Well, thank you very much. And with great humility, I appreciate all that you've done developing this series. It's just been wonderful.
Well, we'll make it even more wonderful today by having you join us, John. You've been a real inspiration to getting this program off and running. So it's altogether fitting that we have you here to talk about that topic. So John and I chatted about what would be of interest. And you know, John is quite the Renaissance person from a physician standpoint. We had lots of different ideas of things, some of which may have spawned future episodes. But one thing that he and I both have a clinical scientific interest in is the area of pharmacogenetics. And well, John, we're going to hear your thoughts on this, but I'll bias everyone with my own. The pharmacogenetics is almost like a Rorschach in the eyes of many practitioners and patients. It's thought to be a projective that you sort of identify in various ways. It's going to tell me things about myself. It's going to make predictions. It's going to help me guide treatment. It's going to override clinical factors, patient-specific features that influence outcome and really get to the heart of things. So as someone who had back in the day an NIH grant looking at pharmacogenetics, I come to this with lots of questions, maybe more than answers, that we can share together about when's it useful, when's it not, how much is it really ready for prime time, how much of it is still, it's a research tool. And last but not least, perhaps, is when a clinician thinks about ordering pharmacogenetic testing, it really should be no different than ordering any other test, which is what question are you looking to answer, not what would this tell me about the universe of the patient and demystify things, but what clinical question will it answer? So with that, John, I'm going to ask you to share with us maybe your own biases about pharmacogenetic testing, how you think about this as someone with a background in biochemistry and neuroscience, and translating that into the hands of the clinician who says, shall I make use of this tool in my everyday practice?
Yes. Well, it's really, for me, it's been a fascinating story. Because when pharmacogenetic testing first became available about 12, 14 years ago, I was excited. And then as I learned more about it and reading the literature and becoming aware of the institutions that exist to vet genes as to whether or not they're clinically actionable, I became very frustrated by how overly adoptive pharmacogenomics has become when it's really this, the evidence base is not there. And in fact, as we've learned more, it's become less evidence-based in terms of clinical applications. But let me just start with one point that I want to emphasize. You and I today, we're simply talking about psychiatric pharmacogenomics, because in other specialties like oncology and hematology, it's a whole different conversation. And so just for the audience, you know, we're going to focus on the role of pharmacogenomics in psychiatry. And for myself, briefly, when I was in an undergraduate in college, I was a biochemistry major in the late 1970s. And I loved biochemistry. I did an honors thesis taking a gene from E. coli, a prokaryote, putting it into a recombinant plasmid that could exist in E. coli and yeast, the eukaryote, and showed that that gene was retained by the yeast. And And that was when we were sequencing with gels and X-rays, and that was 1979, 1980, a long time ago. And I think that for context, we really didn't begin the clinical journey into pharmacogenomics until the Human Genome
Right.
Project was complete. Just the first rough draft was 2001, and then that whole first decade, 2001 to 2010. It went from like 100 papers on pharmacogenomics in 2000, and then there were thousands a year, every year after that. And it just exploded with all kinds of rich information. And I think for me, the grounding principle that evolved during that first decade was in 2009 when the Clinical Pharmacogenomic Implementation Consortium was formed. And it was basically formed, in my understanding, through the Stanford University, St. Jude's Hospital, and the NIMH. And it was created as a nonprofit, expert monitored organization to vet the published literature and to make the determination when a gene crosses the line from being interesting, I call it interesting, versus actionable. Or evidence-based. And so,
Functional polymorphisms, non-silent. When you say actionable, you can.
actionable means in my office, I will write an order for cytochrome P452D6 to get the genotype of it. Whereas, and so in the early teens, there was a lot going on and people just accepted. And Dr. Mrazek, who was at the Mayo Clinic, and actually he was the one who ultimately wrote the at the time in 2010 the authoritative book on psychiatric pharmacogenomics, and basically started innovating in using these tests clinically. But at the time, people were doing the best they could, but in retrospect, they over-idealized and they drew conclusions that were not grounded in science, but were grounded in excitement, in my opinion. And so, an end result of that were these gene panels, which are heavily marketed but are useless. And I say that with all sincerity. And in fact, arguably, they're harmful in a lot of ways. And so, as the literature's evolved, and I'll bring us right up until August of 2025, this past August, the International Society for Psychiatric Genetics published a review article on genetics and psychiatry. And they concluded what I 100% agree with, that there are basically four genes that are evidence-based or actionable. And all of the others are interesting, but we are not able to conclude to make a clinical decision from the results. And just very quickly, those four genes include cytochrome P452D6, and that has 130 alleles or 130 different genes. It's a very complex. We used to phenotype it with dextromethorphan urine levels back before we even knew about pharmacogenomics. So CYP2D6 is very important for us in psychiatry, although, as hopefully we'll talk about, it's not concrete and it's not 100% of what people think it is. The other one is CYP2C19. And for us in psychiatry, that's citalopram, escitalopram, and sertraline. That's it. And then you have HLA B1502, which is an allele from the human histocompatibility complex, where with carmazepine, if you have that gene, you have a significantly increased risk for Stevens-Johnson syndrome or X-related dermatitis. And the one that no one talks about,
If you are from Southeast Asian geographic ancestry.
yeah, but there are people who may not know their ancestry,
Yes. Yep.
and the world is a big place now with people who don't necessarily, unless they do their genetics, may not even know what their actual origins are. But the bottom line.
Stratification is the term people would talk about here. I think ethnic is considered more of a sociological than biological construct these days, but or race, but stratification,
Yes.
where you hail from, because some of the allele frequencies you're talking about will have geographic variation. South Africa versus the Caucasus versus Southeast Asia. And so when we come up with genotype frequencies, when we say things like 2D6 poor metabolizers are maybe 4 to 9% of Caucasians, but up to 29% of Ethiopian Africans. So where you come from does influence some of these genetics, which doesn't get taken into account when people try to interpret these tests.
It doesn't, and it's another layer of complexity. And the last gene is one that also is evidence-based and that has a lot of good data, and that's the HLA-A3101. And if you have that gene, you are at increased risk for DRESS syndrome, drug reaction with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. And it turns out that if you're a European, the odds ratio of you having DRESS syndrome, if you have that gene, is 57, 5-7. So it's a huge increase in risk. But unlike the HLA-B1502, it hasn't become the standard of care. But those are the only four genes that are evidence-based overall. And then you have two minor exceptions, which is cytochrome P53-2C9 for phosphenytoin and phenytoin, and 2B as in ball 6 for sertraline, which I don't think is really helpful because 2C9 to 19 is so much more important. So in 2025, when you look at the experts in the Clinical Pharmacogenetic Implementation Consortium, a lot of those people are integrated into and work with the International Psychiatric Society of Psychiatric Genetics. At the end of the day, from this past August, they say there are four genes. And that's CYP2C19, CYP2D6, HLA-B1502, and HLA-3101. And all of the others are interesting, but to act on them is not evidence-based at this time. Now, I think in 20, 30 years, that list might be 100 long, but we're just not there yet.
So maybe to frame this up for listeners, there's a few ways I think of cutting this pie. One is around pharmacokinetics and drug metabolism. This is where phase one, as well as some phase two enzymes come into play. And the idea that are you going to metabolize a drug too fast, in which case it's out of your system and you can't use it, or too slow, in which case there's two implications that I know of. One is you may just have a buildup of adverse effects, and so a little goes a long way. Or the other is if a parent drug is a parent drug, it needs to be broken into its active metabolite in order for biological activity in the brain. If you're a poor metabolizer, it ain't going nowhere. So this would be the venlafaxine story with 2D6, or the risperidone story with 2D6. If you're a poor metabolizer of the predominant enzyme that breaks it down, and you wonder how come my patient is taking these 2D6 substrates and not getting anywhere, maybe it's because they are a poor metabolizer and can't make the active metabolite. Is that a fair proposition? Let me just stop with that.
Yeah, so for CYP2D6, that is a really important gene. And although it's not in stone, and we'll talk about why that's the case, the bottom line is if that's a gene, everyone should be genotyped for at birth, and seriously. And you look at a tamoxifen, right? Women with breast cancer, and tamoxifen is not an active drug, and it takes CYP2D6 to be converted into I think it's endoxifen, which is
Endoxifen,
the active and which is the active hormone. So if you're getting tamoxifen for chemotherapy, and you're either a poor metabolizer or you're on fluoxetine, paroxetine, or bupropion, you're not going to be getting the blood level of the endoxifen to be on your chemotherapy for 2 years for your breast cancer. And the other side of the coin is a lot of the opioids, where you have like codeine. Which only has 1/20th of the analgesia of morphine. Codeine needs 2D6 to become morphine. And so, if you're a poor metabolizer, you're going to get very little analgesia. Same with oxycodone to hydrocodone, oxymorphone to hydromorphone. But we know that if you're an ultra rapid metabolizer, which is 1% of the population at CYP2D6, that there have been lots of cases of children and infants dying because they're given a Tylenol with codeine after minor surgery. And because the codeine is hypermetabolized to morphine, they stop breathing during the night and die. And the FDA actually increased the warning that codeine should not be given to anyone under the age of 12. They tried with a warning to be mindful, and then no one followed their advice, so they changed it to saying don't use it under 12 because there's a risk, even though it's small, there's a risk for respiratory depression if they're an ultra rapid metabolizer at CYP2D6. So that's where this CYP2D6, that's all, those things are outside of psychiatry. But in psychiatry, we have, first of all, a lot of drugs that are metabolized. The good news, one of my little favorite stories here, the good news about CYP2D6, there are no inducers. So you don't have to worry about any induction of CYP2D6. And when you look at inhibitors, there are really just five. And so you need to memorize those five inhibitors because they will phenoconvert somebody from a normal to a poor or an ultra rapid to a normal. And that's, we know them well, three of them, fluoxetine, paroxetine, bupropion, and then quinidine and terbinafine, which is an antifungal. And so I tell people when I'm giving talks on pharmacogenomics, for CYP2D6, you really want to know that one because it's really, really everywhere and it's really important. And it affects a lot of psych drugs, but there are only five inhibitors which you can memorize and there are no inducers. So that part of the story is easy.
Now, this brings us to a point that our colleague Sheldon Preskorn has made, which is how much does one need to know pharmacogenetic testing results versus needs to know, like the back of your hand, the pharmacokinetic pathways that break down substrates that we're interested in? Because he's published before saying, if you really just understand the P450 and the phase two metabolism of the drug and its various pathways, you might replicate what a pharmacogenetic test result shows in terms of the green, red, and yellow bins. And so, how much does the testing mainly affirm what we'd already know? That is, gee, this person's taking drugs that are 2D6 substrates and having a lot of side effects, no efficacy. I wonder if they're a PM, a poor metabolizer. Let's just change to a different substrate and not even necessarily do the testing. Let me stop with that. What do you think about that Preskorn point?
So I think, and the bottom line is there is a thread of logic there. However, it's too generalized, and there are patients. So, say someone is on citalopram, and they get up to 60 milligrams, and they start having poor tolerability, and to then say, okay, I'm not going to give them sertraline because it's the same metabolic pathway, CYP2C19, those two drugs. So are you going to not give somebody any drugs based on knowing their cytochrome P450 pathway when a lot of times a certain drug may be preferable for whatever reason? And so I think one of the questions, what I like to do, but I'm a nerd, self-acclaimed nerd, what I like to do for any drug is I like to know its pharmacodynamics and its pharmacokinetics. So I want to know how it's metabolized. And so if you look at paliperidone, you don't have to worry about cytochrome P450. If you look at desmethylvenlafaxine, you don't have to worry about cytochrome P450. But if you look at risperidone, you do, but you don't, because risperidone and paliperidone bind D2 about the same. And if you put a 2D6 inhibitor, you're just going to have more risperidone and less paliperidone. Arguably, you're going to have more 5-HT2A antagonism from the risperidone, which is more potent than the paliperidone. But when you get levels, you see that. When you get levels from people who are on risperidone, you'll see a large variation. So I think the bottom line is if you're using a drug, first of all, let me state that I would not routinely get pharmacogenomic testing on anybody. I will only order it if I'm stuck or I have a question or I need to clarify. And so, basically, and that's not common. I might order, and when I order pharmacogenomic testing, I only order the gene I have the question about. So I will order, and a lot of people don't know you can do that. And all you have to do is write an order for, genotype CYP2D6 or 2C19 or HLA-B1502. All the other stuff is garbage anyway. It's just muddying the waters. And then it's of a reasonable cost, and you're getting information on the one gene you're trying to figure out. But that then, in and of itself, is only a small part of the story. And I'll let you decide if you want to bring in this topic or not. But because what we've learned in the arena of epigenetics is ignored currently, but it has a huge impact that will either increase or decrease the serum level of the CYP enzymes based on what the epigenetic modifications are to the gene itself that you've genotyped. So you only get a gene, you get the base pair genotype when you do pharmacogenomic testing, but you don't have any information about the epigenetic factors that are going to determine how much of the gene product is out there, which is going to cause your phenotype, which is what you actively see in terms of the transformation, elimination, or what have you of the drug.
So to rephrase this, you can identify whether someone has a polymorphic variant in a gene that codes for a metabolic enzyme, like one of the P450s or glucuronyltransferase enzyme, that will anticipate for you, this may pose difficulties in the metabolic pathway of the drug and might expect me to see visible signs of side effect tolerability issues, particular side effect concerns like the DHLA-B1502 and Stevens-Johnson syndrome with carbamazepine, and may or may not bear on efficacy. So we think of safety and efficacy separately, as you're kind of alluding to with pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics when we think of pharmacogenetic testing. But then there's the question of how does this actually translate? So epigenetics and this idea of Sheldon Preskorn again is called phenoconversion, that you can have somebody who's got a known genetic variant, and yet there are other ways to determine if their actual phenotype is that of a poor metabolite or separate from genetics, such as you and I have talked about, measuring ratios of metabolites. You want to say a word or two about just doing a test that measures the ratio of the parent to the metabolite?
Yeah, so Dr. Preskorn's study is one of my favorites. I think it was published in 2018, 2018. And what they did was they had about 900 patients and who were all prescribed the venlafaxine XR. And
36 substrate.
yeah, so venlafaxine XR, which affects our XR, is metabolized by CYP2D6 to O desmethylvenlafaxine, which we call PRESTIQ, and O-desmethylvenlafaxine. And the venlafaxine becomes O-desmethylvenlafaxine by CYP2D6. So if you say you're in the middle and you have a middle level activity of CYP2D6, you're not going to get as rapid metabolizer as a rapid or ultra rapid metabolizer at 2D6 of the O-desmethylvenlafaxine, and you're not going to rapidly convert the venlafaxine. But if you're a poor metabolizer, then the venlafaxine is going to build up, and you're going to get less of the metabolite because you have a hard time. You're slower to convert the venlafaxine to O-desmethyl. And so what they did was they said, okay, we're going to take these 900 people, and we're going to genotype them. We're going to take a sample of blood and we're going to look at their DNA sequence of the CYP2D6, two genes. We all have two genes, one from mom, one from dad. And that's going to give us a genotype with a presumed phenotype. So if they have two normal functioning genes, they would be called a normal or extensive metabolizer. And then they were all put on venlafaxine in 8 weeks, roughly up to 8 weeks later, they drew blood. And they drew blood and they quantified the venlafaxine and the O-desmethyl. And so the O-desmethyl is at the top and the venlafaxine is at the bottom. And if there's more O-desmethyl, then the venlafaxine was rapidly converted to the O-desmethyl. That suggests strong CYP2D6 activity, normal, rapid, or ultra rapid. But if there's less desmethyl at the top, there's a lower concentration and a higher concentration of venlafaxine. That's a proxy for 2D6 poor metabolism because the venlafaxine is built up and it's having a hard time going up to
The sink is
O-desmethyl.
clogged.
Yes, exactly. And so if that ratio, O-desmethyl to venlafaxine, if that ratio is one or less, that's a proxy for a poor metabolizer. If it's one or more, it's a normal. If it's a lot more than one, it's an ultra rapid or rapid. So what they did when they looked at, and this is actually one of my favorite studies for this reason. So when they looked at the genotype, which is the test you would get from a pharmacogenetic company, when they looked at the genotype of the 900 subjects, 4% came back as poor metabolizers. When they looked at the ratio of O-desmethyl to venlafaxine, 27% phenotyped as poor metabolizers. So what they then stated, which is a really important point, is that 24% of people who were not poor metabolizers genetically were poor metabolizers phenotypically,
Phenotypically.
based on, and so they then, had their own ideas of speculating why that might be. But so in the that's a real world study of 900 patients. And if they had relied just on their genetic test of CYP2D6, they would have been right with 4% of the patients, but wrong with 24%. And that's the best gene we have. That is the gene we have the most information on. 130 alleles. We've been studying it since the early 1990s.
Which is interesting when you have a patient who's complaining of a lot of side effects, for instance, and someone might be inclined to do testing to affirm whether or not they're a poor metabolizer. Just because the genotyping may come back as a poor metabolizer, as you're pointing out here, doesn't negate the possibility that they may still have a buildup of the parent compound because they're nevertheless phenotypically not converting it. And so the implications of all this, the so what factor for the practitioner, if you and I are in the lab and we're thinking about how does this influence our understanding and knowledge about pharmacology, for the practitioner who's out there, are they over-relying on what those tests can show? Should they be taking other factors into consideration? We haven't even talked about efficacy so much yet, but
Yes.
how does the practitioner sort of make use of a test like this and put it in context so they don't overvalue it?
Yes, so that's a really important point, and one that I've given a lot of thought to. And for me, in my opinion, pharmacogenomic testing should only be done where two of the genes, especially HLA-B1502, if I have a patient of Asian descent, and I'm thinking about carbamazepine, oxcarbazepine, phenytoin, or lamotrigine, before I start that drug, I'm going to look for that allele because that's a pretty straightforward one. And you're looking at a clear gene allele, a polymorphism that if they have it, and if they're of Asian descent, that's the population that carries this gene, then I'm not going to give them those drugs, or I'm only going to give them if they really need it, and I'm going to monitor them really closely. So that's one, that's that bucket. There are only two other genes that are really evidence-based to help us. And one is CYP2D6 and the other is CYP2C19. And as we just talked about with the CYP2D6, you cannot conclusively look at the genotype that you get back and know what's going on in that patient. Because there are many ways that the patient can have undergone phenoconversion. One of them is if they're on, say they're on Quinidine and you didn't know it. Say they're on, or say they're on, they were on fluoxetine. It was stopped a week ago, but the fluoxetine is going to be there for 2 months because of its half-life, and that's going to inhibit CYP2D6. So one type of phenoconversion is a drug interaction phenoconversion. The other type of phenoconversion, which we've really come a long way of understanding, is the epigenetic phenoconversion. In epigenetic phenoconversion, we currently have no tests for. But what we do know is that epigenetics, the way I see it, is the genetics is like the hardware of a computer, and the epigenetics is the software. And so I may have two genes for CYP2D6. I got one from my mother, one from my father, and both of them are rapid metabolizers. So I should be an ultra rapid metabolizer. But at the age of 66, through my lived experience, for whatever reason, environment, diet, stress, for whatever reason, the promoter sequences to my two genes have been hypermethylated. And so, and that is now my epigenome, which is actually real and not as concrete and fixed as my genome, which is just the skeleton. That's the hard drive. But the software is saying, okay, you are actually an intermediate or a poor metabolizer. And so by ignoring the whole impact of epigenetics, it's kind of like we're not operating with the evidence base of our understanding of how genetics works in human systems. And although, which is why for me, I will get a CYP2D6 gene or a CYP2C19 if I'm really stuck and I really want to clarify what is the role of their genotype in this, but it's still not explaining to me their epigenetic phenotype. And I also want to know what are the drugs they're on. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, I think there's a mythology that all you have to do is do the gene testing and you can choose a drug based on the results.
The color of the bin.
I created a lecture years ago, probably 25 years ago, and the title of it was From the Pill Bottle to the Toilet, The Journey of a Drug. And so what's going to affect the serum level? The absorption, transdermal, oral, IM, IV, crossing the gut to get in the bloodstream, cytochrome P450, phase two glucuronidation, cardiac output, renal excretion, hepatic function. There are all these serum albumin. So there are all these other variables that are going to affect the drug level in addition to the pharmacogenetic test you get. And so what I will do if a patient is on a drug and I'm stuck, the very first thing I will do is get a 12-hour post-dose level of that drug. And I think when you get a serum level of a drug, you then have you've factored in all 15 of those other mechanisms, and you're getting the information you really need, which is what is the drug level with what I'm seeing. And I think that that's really happened, although unfortunately it's not clinically utilized as it should be. But all the experts that treat schizophrenia, and obviously Jonathan Myers' book, Antipsychotic Plasma Levels, the current standard of care in schizophrenia is before you change to a different antipsychotic, get a 12-hour post-dose level. If they're on an oral drug, and get a pre-injection level if they're on a long-acting injectable. And then you have a blood level of the antipsychotic, which gives you a lot of information that is telling you what the level is at this time. Maybe they're not taking the drug. That's why it's not working. Maybe it's their pharmacogenomics from cytochrome P450 or UGT. Maybe it's related to some other disease state, or there are so many variables. And by getting the serum level, that gives you a concrete piece of information that you can bookmark, and you can do a lot of actionable decision making, which may start by how come it looks like you're not taking the drug, and it turns out maybe they have a gastrointestinal poor absorption.
So you're really pointing out post-translational factors that will
Yes.
influence the pharmacodynamics that we see. The genes are the starting point, but then lots of things can happen once the transcript is then translated. It's interesting, the way you're framing it about the therapeutic drug monitoring. Some people often think about, well, is there a therapeutic range of a given drug? Some have them, some don't. But to Jonathan Myers' book's point and yours, there's other reasons to get blood levels besides is it in, if it's lithium, is it in the therapeutic range or not, which has to do with if someone's on a relatively high dose, do they have a fairly low level? If they're on a relatively low dose, do they have a high level as an indicator of how much absorption and distribution is actually going on and measurable. And that's different from a therapeutic range. It's
Yes.
it speaks to things. See things like, clearance and metabolism and transport. What if somebody's hypoalbuminemic and they're not making transport proteins? And so you're measuring the valproic acid level and you're surprised by what you get. They're on 20 mg per kilo and yet the level is not reflective of that. You'd have to step away from the genetics and say, is there some other factor that might be influencing what's measurable in terms of a free drug level versus a protein bound level, for instance?
Yes. Just I think it was a really nice affirmation of that. The International Schizophrenia Society, just a few months ago, they updated their guidelines in treating schizophrenia, and they said serum levels should be done to everybody. And we rarely do it. We rarely get them in the United States. But all of the If you do a search with all of the thought leaders in schizophrenia, I have a whole file of them, and they all say serum levels of antipsychotics should be routine and done always. And you're right. The only, it actually it, what I find fascinating is when you go back to when I was a resident. I'm not sure when you were a resident, but I was a resident 1986 to 1991. And during that time, I had psychopharmacology supervisors who were really good basic scientists, pharmacologists. And what did we do? We got lithium levels, carbamazepine levels, valproic acid levels, tricyclic antidepressant levels. And I think we really missed an opportunity in the 1990s by not getting and establishing therapeutic levels of antidepressants and antipsychotics. Because people will say, well, there's no real good baseline of that. You don't really know what the serum level is. And it's like, you're right. And they'll even use that argument for clozapine, which I disagree with. I get clozapine levels all the time. And I think that that's really important. And Jonathan Myers wrote a whole book on that. But the thing is levels are only meaningful if they were obtained through a clearly defined protocol. And that was rarely done. It's just a random level here or there. Who knows what time of day? Who knows when they took their dosages? But if we could have studied the antidepressants and antipsychotics and obtained information, data sets like we have for lithium and valproate and carbamazepine and the tricyclics, I think we would have gained a great deal today if we had that information, culled into basic guidelines. Missed opportunity.
No, I agree. Now let me take us back to being kids in the candy store and back to the bench more than the bedside. One of the things that I think has intrigued many of us about pharmacogenetics is the notion that there are certain known pharmacodynamic players in the system, which, if they are underexpressed, should, I'm going to use that word, should have some impact. And I can think of no better example of that than the MTHFR gene.
Yes.
Boy, what a heartbreaker story that one is. Real briefly, so methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, that enzyme that's necessary to methylate folic acid and let it cross the blood-brain barrier so you can make serotonin, does have known allelic variants of low activity and high activity. And so when one does the proprietary testing on MTHFR and it comes back, it's, I think it's the C677T gene, if it comes back with the low activity variant, one says, ooh, I should give this patient L-methylfolate because the narrative means they're not methylating folic acid, therefore they're not transporting it across the blood-brain barrier. Ergo, I've now used pharmacogenetic testing to affirm my hypothesis. What a beautiful story. The only problem with that beautiful story is that the empirical literature hasn't quite supported it. So when George Papakostas did his study of genotyping C677T MTHFR, and looked at antidepressant response to L-methylfolate, it didn't show up as a clear signal. If there was an effect, it was a small one. So you couldn't say, wow, if you've got the low activity variant, you must replete L-methylfolate. I've always thought of that as a good example of how this should work, but it doesn't. And it before it goes from the bench to the toilet, maybe it needs to spend more time at the bench. Maybe there's some other epigenetic factor that's going on. But I don't know if you have a comment on that example, because I know plenty of people that waive their testing result. Oh, look, I need to take MTH. What, any thoughts about that, John?
I have a lot of thoughts about that, but I won't share all of them. But I will share some of my favorites. So yeah, it's another example of putting the cart before the horse, and so it is a nice story. There are certain assumptions there that are if unless you look deeper into the story that you'll take an action that's not evidence-based. So one of them is yes. So the MTHFR gene has a promoter sequence, and it can be methylated. If you methylate the promoter sequence, you shut down production. If you acetylate the histones, if you acetylate histones, you open up the histones and you increase production. And so you're able to turn on or turn off, kind of like a dimmer switch, depending upon methylating the promoter sequence or acetylating the histones. But more important than that, what is methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase do? It creates a molecule, L-methylfolate, that then becomes a methyl group donor. Well, CME is a methyl group donor. S-adenosylmethionine is a methyl group donor. There are lots of methyl group donors. So even if you have poor functioning MTHFR, you may be compensating for that by having other methyl group donors that are doing a great job, which is why the person did not benefit from what you tried to do. Whereas we do have a publication, and I don't re remember the source, but they showed if you just take a large number of patients on SSRIs that are non-responders, and you add L-methylfolate to all of them, about a third of them will get better. And so what I tell people is you can use L-methylfolate as an augmenting strategy without, you don't need to get an MTHFR. That shouldn't influence your decision. So it's, we have lots of augmentation strategies, and one of them is, well, you could always augment an SSRI with MTHF with L-methylfolate, and they may get better, but don't make that decision based on their MTHFR genotype, because that is not evidence-based.
But that's the heartbreaker. I mean, if ever there was a story that should say, wow, this is doing something by way of personalized medicine, this should have worked. But as you point out, there may be other reasons why methylation may.
Another in that same bucket is the SLC6A4. So that's the serotonin
Your
transport pump.
transport gene, yep.
There's a lot of people in a lot of these panels that still test for that. They test for lots of things that are not evidence-based, and that's one of them. And fortunately, we have the Clinical Pharmacogenomics Implementation Consortium, and we have the International Society for Psychiatric Genetics, both of whom concluded that SLC6A4 and MTHFR are not evidence-based. And that even though, again, they're seductive, there are contradictory results no matter how you look at or slice the picture. So again, it's interesting, but we know that at least with SLC6A4, that methylation plays a really big part in the actual functionality of the gene products. And there's a lot of literature that substantiated that. But the epigenetic part of the story is still in early stages, and we don't have any testing other than research, in academic research types of studies. And those are quite fascinating. But it's a piece of the story that you can't ignore, because it so much can impact the genotype you're looking at. And if you don't realize that this isn't as black and white as I'd like it to be, and the MTHFR is, it makes me sad. It's a disappointing, because I thought I could put my hat on it, but I can't. So it's the case where the future is bright, but we have to know about the facts in the present and operate from the evidence base, which is why we fortunately have the CPIC and the ISPG, which help keep us in the guardrails of what's evidence-based.
So, for my Hanukkah wish list, maybe not for the current calendar year, but for some calendar year, boy, it would be nice to know if there is a gene or gene panel that would be informative about agranulocytosis or neutropenia with clozapine. Boy, would it be nice to have a gene panel that would be informative about predicting the likelihood of antipsychotic-induced weight gain or metabolic dysregulation or tardive dyskinesia and all the various side effects of it. Boy, it would be nice to know if I could replicate some of the earlier studies that said if you're short on SLC6A4, you've got a higher chance of getting manic or hypomanic with an SSRI than if you're long, because long is protected. These are studies that have been done preliminarily without replication or without reaching the point at which we could go and do a test and say, I can predict with some measurable certainty the chance that a certain outcome is going to happen based on whatever contribution to your outcome is genetically based. And I think it's for that reason that FDA issued their consumer advisory warning in 2018 against routinely doing pharmacogenetic testing with the idea it's going to tell you what to do. It really, I don't know if it belongs to the toilet, but I do think it still belongs at the bench for clinician researchers, investigators to be able to ask questions about under what circumstances and with what combinatorial approaches and factoring epigenetic factors Can we or can we not use or come up with someday a genetic test that's going to give us some information about the genetic contribution to some outcome, whether it's adverse or whether it's beneficial? I think we don't know that yet.
Yes, and I agree. I more than anybody would love to be able to use pharmacogenomic testing every day in every patient. But I'm a scientist at heart and I have to follow the science. And so I can't use something that I know is not evidence-based and then act upon it because I'm doing harm. I'm drawing conclusions that are not based on the foundation of good care, a foundation of what the facts and the organizations that I do trust. I really trust CPIC and I really trust ISPG. And so it's kind of like, if I'm asking if I need a vaccine or not, I'm going to go to an infectious disease doctor because I'm just a psychiatrist. And I'm going to say, what do you think, specialist, expert in vaccines? Do you think I should get the shingles vaccine? And I will listen and I will follow their advice. Whereas so basically we have those two organizations that are holding our hands and creating guardrails, and that's all they do. They're the experts. But for some reason, people don't want to believe it. And I think it goes back to Santa Claus. People want Santa Claus to be real, right? They really do. They want the Easter Bunny to be real. And so it's like, well, but it's sexy. Getting this gene panel—it really, it's sexy, and the way they're marketed is they imply that you're going to be doing cutting-edge, smart stuff to help your patients, and so unfortunately, that's been a successful marketing strategy, and it's had a huge impact. But you're right. In 2018, the FDA made their announcement, and that was the very first publication from the American Journal of Psychiatry, from the American Psychiatric Association, 2018, Dr. Carpenter, Dr. Nemeroff. And they said basically, at this time, there's no evidence that gene panels are helpful and they should not be used. And in May of 2024, at the APA, they published an update, the American Psychiatric Association, and they said nothing has changed from our view. Since 2018, they still should not be used. And then in 2021 and 2023, CPIC and ISPG both published their summary reviews where we stand. And all of that stuff is consistent with those four genes, 2D6, 2C19, HLA-B1502, HLA-A3101. And everything else, with minor exceptions, Dilant, phenytoin, with minor exceptions, phenytoin, and then CYP2B6 with sertraline, which again is a minor player. That is what we can say are evidence-based genes in our profession of psychiatry. But the good news is, I may not live to see it. I hope I do. In 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, as we get more information and as we get smarter and as we learn ways to look at the epigenetic changes that will then help us have a better understanding of gene expression, that will help us make more informed decisions. But again, in the context of all those other variables that are also impacting response or blood levels. So
Indeed.
yeah, the good news is it's a fun time. There's a lot going on, but we have to be humble about what we know and what we don't know.
And the demarcation point between the bench and the bedside. We don't go do functional MRIs in everybody with a psychiatric condition. We're very selective, and we do it for a reason because we have a hypothesis. Maybe there's age-inappropriate atrophy. Maybe we have some neurological sign. It really should spark the curiosity of the clinician to think, would a test, any test for that matter, be informative to answer a question? That's how I always think about any test in medicine. Pharmacogenetics is the same as imaging, is the same as getting a comprehensive metabolic profile. It's not meant to be a shotgun. So let's just run it through, the Cuisinart and see what comes out. It's because I have a hypothesis that I like to test, right?
Yes.
So final question for you here. For the patient who inevitably will call our colleagues and say, can you do that gene test that'll tell me which drug to take? What's a polite and respectful way to answer that question, would you say to the patient?
Yeah, so I've actually been asked that a lot. And What I say is, what I'm going to say, I'm going to share out. I consider myself an expert in psychopharmacology. I started out life in molecular genetics, and I love this field. And I, more than anyone, would love to give you a test that would help me treat you better. But based on everything I know, in my opinion, these tests are not helpful, and they can unintentionally result in decisions that may not help you. So I will use the knowledge I do have to help you find the right drug or treatment, therapy, sleep hygiene, whatever it happens, all of those things. But I'll work with you on that. But in my opinion, it's not. And then if they push the envelope more, then I will go on to say, well, the FDA, the organization CPIC, and the ISPG, all the experts agree with my opinion, and I trust them. And so if you know
So maybe this is sort of sidestepping. I'm sorry, there is no Easter bunny. I hate to break it to you, but to say, look, we have a common goal. We want to do it scientifically informative for you. If there is a test out there that I think will help us answer a question, I promise you I will order it. But not everything comes down to a particular test, right? I mean, there are certain clinical impressions we have in medicine. How do you diagnose migraine headaches? There's no test for that. How do you diagnose irritable bowel syndrome or tinnitus? There's no test for that. So we look for tests to someday enhance or augment what we think is an observation that we'd like some corroboration for. But let's bring it back to the basic grounding of a good clinician is going to use testing selectively and thoughtfully and scientifically to either support a hypothesis that they have or to help them prove or disprove something, but not as a kind of a Ouija board that's just going to answer questions. And maybe the demystification for the patient or the colleague is to say every test that you order should be for a reason, have a very specific reason if you're going to order any test.
Yes.
All right. Well,
Agreed.
John, maybe I don't know if you missed your calling by going into publishing. But I guess if you're going to keep your day job, you can certainly do more with your night job and help our colleagues learn more and understand more about the ways in which tests such as pharmacogenetics have a limited role and are still very much the focus of evolution. And can't wait till what'll be on the Hanukkah Christmas list for 2035 or 2040. The field is still moving forward, lo these many years after its nascent inception. So, any final comments you'd like to share before we stop?
Yeah, I will end by saying I love genetics, and I love pharmacogenomics, and I'm very optimistic that moving forward, a time will come when it will inform a lot of what we do, and the whole notion of personalized medicine will become more applicable. But again, it's a silly metaphor, but it's a good one. We don't want to put the cart before the horse, and so let's stick to what the experts who really know this stuff are guiding us, and then incrementally use what becomes what I call clinically actionable or evidence-based. And the good news is we do have those guides in the organizations I've mentioned. And so it's a really important topic. I've been passionate about it since 2015. And I'm excited to see where it ends. And it is great to have this conversation with you. So thank you.
Likewise, and I share the enthusiasm. So stay tuned and hopefully more to come down the road. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today on this topic of the controversies around pharmacogenetic testing and clinical psychopharmacology. Hope you all have all enjoyed this dialogue and discussion. If you have, come back to hear more in our next episode of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, wishing you good clinical experiences ahead and scientifically informed knowledge, and keep coming back. And we'll see you again back here sometime real soon. Take care for now.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.